rebirth, escalation, there is old age and death, but sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair come to being, such as the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Suppose, because a great bonfire was burning, consuming 10, 20, 30, or 40 loads of wood, and a man would cast dry grass, dry powder, dry wood into it from time to time, thus sustained by that material, fueled by it, the great bonfire would burn for a very long time. So too, when one lives contemplating gratification, things that can be clung to, craving increases, and then from craving, that whole process of dependent origination, ending with old age and death and suffering, such as the whole origin of this whole mass of suffering. Here you can see, often we just talk about some aspects of dependent origination. Here we're just looking at the links from craving to suffering, the last five links of dependent origination. Very often, that is sufficient to show us how the process works. So here we're talking about this thing called gratification, probably what it is harder, probably like the delight, the positive quality of something, And in the suttas, you often have these three factors that the Buddha talks about. It's the asvada on the one hand, which is the gratification. The adhidara is like the danger or the downside of things, the negative side. And the last one is the nisvana. Nisvana is the escape from things. And these things are kind of three aspects to existence. It's one way of looking at our life. From a Buddhist point of view, we recognize that very often what we do is we look at the delighted things, we look at the gratification. And the more we think about the gratification, the more attached we become to things. So you look at the gratification in the... I'm not going to mention BMWs You look about gratification, having a nice house, a nice home. Everybody wants to have a nice home. Or you look at the gratification in a nice relationship. We all want to have nice relationships. There's no point in having a relationship if it's not going to be nice. What's the point of being married if your husband or wife is not very terrible? There's no point anymore. So we're always looking for gratification in those things. So when you look at another person, you see all the good things. This is going to be the perfect husband, this is the perfect wife. That's the divine quality. That is seeing the asana. Seeing the idea of us, and this is what we're trying to do. This is very much part of the Buddhist practice, of understanding the downside, And please don't despair when you look at the downside. because it is important to remember that, because we need a realistic view of the world, and the Buddha helps us to supply our us with that realistic point of view. So remember, this person, maybe they have some good qualities, But also remember that when you fall in love with someone, falling in love means seeing just the good stuff. You're going to be blind to the bad stuff. You don't even want to see that. So very often when you get married, you go to this by all those other qualities of this person as well. The realities are much more complex. We all been there, you fall in love, especially when you're young, when you're very young, kind of in your teens, early 20s or whatever, and you are at that point in life, it seems our emotions are much stronger. And when you get older, your emotions become much more even. But when you're young, there's very powerful emotions very often. And it's often blind. It's not realistic. It's not what you see is nothing to do with reality at all. Reality is far more complex. So that's part of that. But of course, the Adinava is much more. The Adinava is all of these things that we have been talking about already. Relationships that they cannot last. Either you get divorced or when you die, at least when you die. So even if you do have a incredibly nice partner in life, eventually you're going to have to part from them. And it's difficult. So it's always going to be hard. So remember that the deen of outsider. And this is a kind of the Buddhist approach to things. And when the idea that is to weigh up the asada, the gratification, the positive side, in something, we weigh that up with the adhinava, which is the danger, and then we see what is the right approach with this. And then we understand that actually having a little bit less attachment is probably a good thing, it's probably a positive thing. So then, when get onto the path of less attachment, and through that less attachment, we're able to access other types of happiness that are far more profound than those happinesses that we were looking for in the world in the first place. And then we're moving towards the nisarana, the release from all of that. As our attachments decrease, we find more release in the world. Yeah? We're finding more, our mind gets released. When the mind gets released, that is where it has access to higher happinesses. Ultimately, we find the highest kind of release. So this is quite a nice way of thinking about the world, yeah? And this is what the Buddha did through his awakening. He kind of did just that. He weighed up the happiness of the world, yeah? Okay, not so much. He weighed up the dangers, okay? Quite a lot of dangers, okay? Escape is the only sensible solution here, yeah? And that's what he did. It's hard to see this, and it takes a lot of contemplation to be able to see this. And the reason is because it's so ingrained in us, the idea of seeing the pleasures in the world. Yeah? It's very deep. We have such a vested interest in that. I'm sure you can see, understand a little bit of what the Buddha is talking about with the danger, but to see fully is actually quite hard. So don't expect that. Just don't worry too much about it. Just as long as you have some feeling for it, it's enough to move in the right direction. So, whenever you contemplate the gratification, yeah, in that relationship, in that house, in that whatever worldly thing it is, craving becomes greatest, yeah? If you go on, that house is so beautiful, every time you think about that house, the craving to get it becomes more, it becomes stronger for the relationship or whatever. It reminds me of that, you may have heard, probably heard about this, there's this idea of the law of attraction. Yeah, and I call it the law of craving, yeah, because it's the idea of if you focus enough on something and you keep your mind on that, eventually you will get to that kind of the idea. You just have to kind of focus on it all the time. But actually what it does is it almost amounts to craving, yeah. And of course if you crave something, I suspect the way it works, if you crave something enough, then eventually you will kind of find a way of getting it, yeah. Whether it's dodgy or not dodgy or whatever. So sometimes this moment, that's probably why it works sometimes, yeah? Because you never give up, you just keep on going, 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 going. And in the meantime, just craving, 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 craving. Yeah? It's the law of craving, and when you eventually get it, it won't be all that satisfying anyway. Yeah? It's the kind of crazy idea, in my opinion, that don't go for the law of attraction, go for the don't go for the law of craving, go for the law of anti-craving instead, like the Buddha's law of that. So, but as with many things, there's a little bit of truth in it, a tiny bit of truth that masks the massive downside. Yeah? This is kind of what's going on. It's a very worldly way of thinking, this kind of normal form of attraction thing. Anyway, then when you contemplate the gratification and things, yeah, then of course you crave, you're craving, 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 yeah. And because you crave, you attach more, or you take up new things, or you start doing things. And because of that, this whole sequence that comes. I'm not going to go into it now, the last parts, because I will look at that in a second, in a little bit more detail. All the suffering comes about. So what you're doing, you're adding fuel to the fire. Remember the word upadana has two meanings. Upadana literally means to take things up, yeah? But it also means fuel. So it means fuel for the fire. So when you take something up, it's fuel for suffering, it's fuel for life. Just in the same way that wood and sticks and all of these kind of things is fuel for fire. So you are adding fuel every time you do this. Then the fire lasts for a long time, and the fire goes on and on and on and on. So that is the wrong way of approaching life, yeah? And then comes the alternative. Because when one dwells contemplating danger in things that can be clung to, craving ceases, or at least goes down initially. With the cessation of craving comes the cessation of attachment. With the cessation of attachment, the cessation of existence. Cessation of birth, cessation of old age, death, sorrow, temptation, pain, displeasure, and despair all cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Suppose, because a great bonfire was burning, consuming 10, 20, 30, or 40 loads of wood. And a man would not cast dry grass, dry cattle, or dry wood into it from time to time. Thus, when the former supply of fuel is exhausted, that great bonfire, not being fed with any more fuel, lacking sustenance, would be extinguished. So too, when one lives contemplating the danger and things that can be come to, craving comes to an end, etc., etc. And such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So here you see the danger, and as you see the danger, you recognize that there's no point in craving for this. And of course, part of this is very important part of this is always that you balance things out, because we need happiness. You always build up that alternative happiness, which is spiritual happiness, so that you're able to let go of the other one. If you see danger too quickly and without bringing up something in its place, you're going to have a terrible life. Because we need to have happiness in life. Yeah? So, with sensual pleasures, again, be careful. Don't try to kind of force the pace with these things. Just move gradually. These things will happen at their own natural pace. Otherwise, it will be too hard, and you're just going to end up giving up because of that. So you stop fueling the fire, you stop seeing all the positivity, and then because of that, this fire goes out by itself. When you eventually, the fire just goes out, it means you become cool, the cool one. One of the nice epithets of an Arahant is the cool one, the Siddhibuddha. It means the one who has become cool. Yeah, so if you want to entice the younger generation, they all want to be cool, so if you want to be really cool, this is the way to true coolness. Otherwise, all the coolness is kind of superficial, but that is the real cool in the world. It's not about what kind of sunglasses you wear that makes you cool, it's kind of this bit more profound than that. This is the coolness that happens as a consequence. The fuel goes out, and the fire is extinguished. And then no more sustenance, and it's all gone out. Nibbana literally means extinguishment. And extinguishment of the fires of green hatred and delusion, that's what it's all about. So there you are, that is just a little bit about how this process works. When you contemplate the gratification in things that can be clung to, what you really are, you're buying into positive feelings. It comes back to the idea of feeling again. You're thinking about it, and when you think about it, it feels good. And when it feels good, the things that can be clung to, that is where the craving comes from. Feeling craving, then you take it after, and then it carries on like that. Let's have a look at the next sutta, a very similar one, but just to kind of drive home the point a little bit there. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha on Mount Bolshupi, the Nijakuta. Then Sakka, the Lord of the Devas, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, stood to one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, what is the cause and the reason that some beings here do not attain Nibbana in this very life? And what is the cause and reason why some beings here do attain Nibbana in this very life?" That's the question, And there is a few questions like that in the sutta where the Buddha is asked precisely this. What is the reason why someone attains Nibbana? Of course, you could answer, you could say, well, it's because the fact is no blameable path or they don't do that. But sometimes it's nice to home in on some very specific areas. And it kind of opens up a new kind of understanding, a new approach for understanding this. It's kind of like that Sakka here. Sakka comes down to the Buddha and asks him, Then called the Venerable Sir, and then Sakka, of course, he was a stream entry, according to the sutras. So sometimes people say, I'm not sure if I want to be reborn in heaven because I can't practice, but for goodness sake, the boss in heaven, the Supreme Commander, he's a stream entry. It's pretty good deal, isn't it? Imagine if you had more stream entry in this hour to lead our would be really nice. But instead of being stream entries, often our politicians are instead. That's not the problem. So I think some of them in heavenly realm would be great to go to the heavenly realm, and if it's ruled by someone like that, that constitutes that. Of course, that's why he comes to the Buddha and asks these kind of questions. It's obviously that Buddha would ask a question about the social calendar, and that's why this happens. But it's kind of the idea of Sakka, the Lord of the Devas, coming down and visiting you. Imagine that happening here. What would you do if that happened to you? This light comes down, Would you be scared? Would you be kind of all strung? You wouldn't know what to do. It would be really kind of weird. There is a nice little place in the suttas where, which sutta is this again? It's one of the suttas where a sakka comes to the world. I don't think it's a Sakkapanya sutta. The most famous sutta of the meeting between the Buddha and Sakka is the Sakkapanya sutta, which means the questions of sakka. Don't think it's there. I think it's somewhere else. And then the Sakka comes down and the Buddha asks him, you're asking me this question, but before I answer the question, may I ask you another question? Have you asked anyone else the same question before? And then Sakka, yes, I've asked all these other wanderers, yeah, the standard set of wanderers, Purana Kassapa, Sanjaya Vrashi Kutta, the kind of the standard group of six, yeah? And then the Buddha said, well, what happened when you asked this other wanderer this question? Yeah, what happened? And then he said, well, when I kind of came down, I was so awestruck, he saw me coming down, that instead of kind of me having a chance to ask them the question, they wanted to become my disciples, because they thought I was God or something. Yeah? So all of this other one, they wanted to become my disciples. And this is the problem. When you see something like that, you know, something just absolutely out of the ordinary, something extraordinary, what happens? You start believing in God. Yeah, and you think, oh, I was a Buddha, that was a big mistake, because now I see God, I must become a Christian instead. That's what you think, yeah, when you see this kind of enormous light. Oops, that book is falling off, I get too excited here. and this is kind of the problem here. Yeah. So, but remember that this is all about kind of supernatural phenomena. What you are seeing there, you're seeing this light, you're seeing something magnificent. But just because it is magnificent doesn't necessarily mean that there is any wisdom there or there is any profundity there. This is why I think often we kind of go wrong as human beings. We mistake marvelous and amazing phenomena for depth, for insight, for understanding. But that isn't always the case. So here you have this amazing God, they come to the Buddha and ask for advice. Yeah. And this is kind of what is so interesting. That's what makes it so fascinating. Buddha is teacher of gods and human beings. And our Buddhist culture is also very much like that. You know, if you go to, I don't know what it's like here in Malaysia, but that probably is like that everywhere. But if you go to Thailand, it's all about miracles. It's all about supernormal powers. Yeah? And, people talk about these stories. Yeah? And this is kind of what they kind of that makes the Buddhist life kind of interesting. Yeah, all this story. And it is kind of interesting. But at the end of the day, it's just entertainment. Yeah, that's all it is. Yeah? Okay, you see someone rise in the air. Okay, and you see this kind of remarkable, someone walks through the wall. And, actually, I would love to see that walk, someone is walking through the wall. at the end, it doesn't make any difference whether someone walks through the wall or not. And then someone comes and says, yeah, but he's just a magician anyway, you know, this is kind of all illusions. And you think, well, we're actually not really walking through the wall, this is just some kind of magician. And of course, magicians do these things all the time. They do this kind of weird stuff, and you wonder, how on earth is it possible? So at the end, you know, we get too kind of excited by these things. A little bit of this is kind of interesting. We want to get kind of our entire life kind of is about all these kind of things. It goes too far. And I think this is a problem in contemporary Buddhism. It's probably been a problem for a long time. That these things become a substitute for the real Dharma, the real practice, what it really is about. Yes. Yeah, please. Okay, how is it possible? We have many wives. Yeah, I think, yeah. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's platonic relationship. You know, platonic relationship, the only friends, yeah. I I don't know. I think it is possible. You can still have a kind of ordinary relationship, enjoy your SP metric. Yeah, it's possible. Yeah.
Great big wall along the lines.
Yeah. I don't know. I think maybe when you are in the heavenly realm, and you have no choice, you have to have somebody wise. That's what happens in the heavenly realm. Yeah? So whether you're interested or not, you have them there. You have this enormous talent. So this is what happens when you meet one invest there. I'm not sure. But one of the interesting things in that story is, I think this is from Magic Money Camp 27, the great, the sort of discourse of destruction of craving, I think. And this is where Mahamangalana goes to heaven, and at the one hand. Mahamangalana goes up there, and the palace of Satka, and there's an enormous palace, 700 towers, and in each tower there is seven rooms, and there's seven nymphs in each room. Is that the story? Yeah.
I can't really remember. I remember there's a big chariot, and there was a huge, and it was quite over the line.
Quite old wives, then.
Yeah,
really?
I have to get that by Pali Nolwise.
Okay, is it in the Sutta, then?
I think.
Fighting over wives? Okay, yeah. I can't remember fighting over wives. There is some.
If you can find it,
yeah, find it tonight, and then come back with it, yeah, and then maybe we can refuse some views based on certain sutras. But there is a lot of fighting in the sort of between the Sakha and the gods and the Asuras, yeah, you see this all the time. But many of these things are not very Buddhist. Many of these things have been taken over from the existing culture in India at the time.
There was one that they made, the Sakya made the Asuras drunk upon the world.
Is it drunk? Okay. The spell of him perhaps on it. Yeah, something like that. Okay. Bring it out tonight. We will have a look at it. And we will see what happens. But the story, I mean, even when the Sakya industry mentor, I think we don't know. Yeah, it's very hard to be sure about these things. And especially those things that end in the street that claim that someone was a street mentor or there was something else. Very often those are quite unreliable parts of the sutras. So. Because who would really know that? The Buddha doesn't know these things. Sometimes he may be clear, but normally he doesn't. So who can possibly know? At the very end, there's a false teaching amongst the Arahants, okay? And then you read the Sen Sutta in the Chinese translation, it says one person became a street mentor. So which one is right? And this is where you start to become a little bit skeptical about this kind of claim, because you realize there's a lot of uncertainty about that. So it doesn't matter so much. So, but the point also is that as a street mentor, it is not impossible to enjoy essential pleasures. And in that sutta I was just talking about, the shorter sutta of destruction of craving, Magic Money Camp 37, Mahamoggallana goes up to heaven and he meets Sakya, and he looks at Sakya and he sees that Sakya is just too preoccupied with building things, building new palaces, and maybe with his wives, I don't know, his brother, but possibly. And there's so many wives, I need a bigger palace. So he asks him, he realizes that even at his remainder, he's too preoccupied about this, he's forgetting about the Dhamma. So then he asks him this question about the destruction of craving through a verse. And then he asks Sakya whether he can remember that. And then Sakya kind of comes to his senses that he can remember it again. This is the problem. As a street man, you still, sometimes you have right view, but you still forget yourself. And you still kind of get, caught up in worldly things again. It can happen for a street mentor as well. And once you get back to the Dhamma, once you get back to the Sutta, once you get back to your meditation practice, it comes back to you again very quickly then. So it's not entirely possible that a street mentor would have many wives, it's not impossible then. It's kind of unfair, the heavenly realm. You always hear about the gods having many wives. What if you're a female god? It's kind of unfair. Do you have many husbands?
I wouldn't want husbands,
maybe. Do you want 700 husbands? I don't know. It's kind of strange. I don't know exactly how these things actually work out in reality. But I think the idea, and I think this is, as a Brahms idea, that you create the heavens, you find the heavens, you create whatever you want, basically. That's how it works out. Otherwise, it sounds incredibly unfair. Yes?
I find the story of Sakya very interesting. The law of the state. And it kind of seems to me that he managed to be born himself into a higher realm. At the time that he's really Buddha wasn't, you know, wasn't enlightened yet. It was therefore he was the Buddha of the time.
Yeah.
And there were he that were sort of the first disciples.
Yeah.
You should read the question of, do you see Buddhism to glorify your Dharma and Dharma? And do you see the question of people of other religions, religions are generally good, they encourage people to do things.
Sometimes then.
No, I mean, if you read Christians or Muslims or whatever, good ones, they continue to do things like karma points.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe in their language, but
sure.
Yeah. So, there's more than one way to get that.
Ah, but there's not more than one way, you see. Because the way is the same. Because they are good, yeah? The goodness that gets to that way, yeah? So, the way is actually the same. Remember, the difference between Buddhism and many other religions, that Buddhism is about the universal teaching. It's about how the world works. It's an explanation. This is how the world works. So, because it is an explanation of how things function, it doesn't matter whether you're a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim or an atheist or you believe in Thor, yeah? This is I'm no Norwegian, so it's an atheist who believes in Thor and Odin. Right? If you are a kind Thor worshiper, yeah, you can go to heaven then. Maybe. So it is all about natural law. That's what Buddhism really is about. And because it's about natural laws, it is a universal principle, and it's irrelevant whether you are Muslim or whatever. As long as you do those things that lead to heaven, those things are kindness, those things are generosity, those things are compassion. Yeah. Yes, there are things, of course, in Christianity that are not compatible with Buddhism. But this part is compatible, and because it is compatible, it leads to exactly the same results. So, this is what is important about this. And actually, there is a nice sutta that tells how Sakya would be born in heaven. Well, yeah? The sutta is like everything. I always say to people, the sutta is absolutely every problem you can think of, you can find some solution to it in the sutta. So. And there's a sutta that talks about how Sakya got there. And I can't remember the sutta because there's too many sutras to remember, but it's something about him was being in the truth. But isn't it? You want to look it up? Where are you going to go there? It's in the Sakya Sanyutta. Yeah. The 11th Sanyutta was in the Kaya. He's got it there. Wow, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I've got it too.
We've got this research team there. and one of the things that he did was to be very
clear,
always speaking the truth, I think.
You're not
going to
be.
And a few things like that. That's what led him to be rebirth. But he didn't have much news, yes? He wasn't a Buddhist. He was just a good person. Exactly as you said. Yes, just one second. What was interesting when I went to Indonesia recently, I can't remember if I mentioned this already, but they have already. Because in Indonesia, they have a lot of Muslim culture talks. They don't have that separation between the Christians. And often the Muslims in the audience will ask me questions. Yeah? And they will often like to ask me tricky questions, which is interesting. It's always nice to get tricky questions, because otherwise you've heard all the questions already. Oui, thank you, Jerry. It's very kind of you there. Okay, just put it up here. And one of the questions they ask is, well, you know, if a Muslim or a Christian or a Buddhist, if they all practice loving kindness properly, yeah, does it have the same result? Is it the same thing? Yeah? And the answer, of course, is yes. Yeah, if you really practice loving kindness, you know, you can't just limit it to, I'm just going to have loving kindness for the Buddhists or just for the Muslims. You have to really have it for everyone. If you practice it properly and fully, it will have exactly the same results. Yeah? Again, it doesn't matter. It's only when you go really high on the path. When we're talking about insight at the very end of the path, that is where there is a difference. But even then, if you, the Buddha says in the Mahayana Sutta, we're looking at the very beginning here, if you practice the Noble Eightfold Path, then you will get those results, and you will also attain Nibbana. But it's more difficult if you are a Muslim and a Christian, it's more likely that you will have a view which is opposed to the path. And that's why it becomes very hard to practice the Noble Eightfold Path but if you have certain views. Because right view is at the very beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path. But, so that is where the blockage often comes. But if you are a very open-minded Muslim or Christian, maybe even that can be
transcended. There will come a point where the emotional distress raises the effects of you mentioned about the other way to get that.
I'm not really sure.